Grab the popcorn today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. After the FBI indictments over Russian election meddling, President Trump tweeted that they're laughing their tails off in Moscow. Okay, he used a different word, but still, at the very least, Russians do seem entertained.
If it's not your president, right, you can sort of have fun with it. And so to them, it's more of like, you know, eat the popcorn and watch the crazy happen in real time.
Also, Black Panther makes box office history and portrays the African continent in a new light.
Africa shown as a modern place, Africa shown as a futuristic, highly technological place, Africa shown as a place of beauty.
Those stories, minus the popcorn, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us on this President's Day. So here's a plot straight out of a political thriller for you. A sinister force from afar cleverly infiltrates the country and destabilizes the government. Now, I could be talking about Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, the kind of things that were outlined in Robert Mueller's indictment, which singled out 13 people and three Russian companies for interference in the U.S. election. But I could just as easily be describing the new Marvel superhero movie Black Panther, which made a very successful debut this weekend. Good thing you're here with us today because we're going to cover both. Let's start with Black Panther. I saw it at 10 on Saturday morning, and the theater was packed even then. On the other coast, Hanna Baba and Leela Day, host of the podcast The Stoop, they checked it out as well. Hanna Baba says she was more than a little worried going in.
I honestly, being an African myself, I was very wary and very scared.
What were you wary about? What were you scared about seeing?
I'm not used to Africa being seen in a positive light at all in media, whether it's TV or film. Growing up, never. I can't remember seeing Africa portrayed in a way that made me proud to be from Africa.
And what was it? What was the thing that made you most proud? What did you see that made you most proud in this movie?
Just from the get-go, Africa shown as a modern place, Africa shown as a futuristic, highly technological place. I went intense, just like, you know, I had coming to America phobia or itis, right, or like post-traumatic coming to America disorder.
So, Leela, what were your thoughts?
I'm not a big action-adventure type of moviegoer. So I was kind of like, okay, I want to see this, but, you know, it's not really my genre.
I hear you
But I just really, really loved the black women in this film were just powerful, and they were like the center. They were grounding like so many people. But to see so many darker skinned women in these lead roles, it was just empowering.
I mean, what's interesting about the portrayal of women, though, they're central characters, calling some shots. The general is a woman, and that all female militia, you don't mess with them. But at the end of the day, none of them is a contender for the throne. I mean, the men dominate, right?
That's true. But you know, what about in the sequel? What are we going to see? What's going to happen? Maybe the general.
For me, this spoke to, this is Hanna, how it resembles real African history. In particular, these warrior women were not foreign to me. I know, for example, my own ancestors in the Kush kingdoms and the Nubian kingdoms. Queens were warrior queens, right? They led the armies, the Candaces of Nubia. They fought off Byzantines. They fought off Romans. But Marco, you're right. At the end of the day, like, they were the queens who fought. But at the end of the day, the king did make the decision. So it was familiar to me.
Right.
So I know you don't do everything together, even though you do host this podcast, The Stoop, together. You went to see the movie separately. As you started to talk about it, did you find things that you saw differently as an African who is American, Hanna, and Leela, an African-American? Where did you kind of like start to see the differences in what you both saw?
This film brought together so many different types of clothing from different tribes in Africa, and for me, it did not feel messy.
Yeah.
It did not feel disrespectful.
I was going to ask you about that because I was seeing like painted homes from the South African Ndebele people, Maasai necklaces from East Africa, mud prints from Mali and West Africa, lip plates from, well, hardly anybody, I think. Do they still wear them in Sudan? I don't know. But
no.
It seemed it seemed all over the shop, so I didn't know if that was just me getting a little upset at the lack of authenticity or if I was just, like, missing something.
I mean, it's a fantasy sci-fi film where they were trying to bring together all of these different cultures and all of these different textiles to create this fantasy fiction place. So I just thought it was this attempt to show a richness in African culture, mm-hmm. you know, through doing this.
Yeah. I think during the film, it felt like, oh, that guy's wearing something that's Nigerian. That guy is wearing mm-hmm. something that looks like it's from the Maasai. Okay. It was a little, but I feel like the benefit for me outweighed the cringe, if that makes sense.
That yeah. totally makes sense. Let's talk about the only two white actors, the supporting actors in the movie, the evil Claw, a South African thug, and then the CIA operative Everett Ross. He emerges as a hero. I mean, given the CIA's history in Africa, that kind of comes as a bit of a surprise. And I would suspect to Patrice Lumumba in Congo, who was overthrown with help from the CIA, he'd have found that surprising, too. What do you think?
For me, like, that whole scenario of the CIA operative being a sort of...
This is Leela, you know, now, right?
Ally. Yeah, this is Leela being a sort of ally in the end. For me, that's sort of what this film was doing. It's making you question who is the ally and who's the villain. You start to question, should I be standing behind him? Could I stand behind someone like that? So I think that that's what this film is doing. It's challenging who's in the right and who's in the wrong and why.
Yeah, this is so much more than just a superhero movie. I mean, the talking points that this opened up, this film, like resource extraction in Africa and Afrofuturism and what might have been had there not been slavery, or the notion of revenge versus forgiveness, Malcolm versus Martin. I mean, it's more than a movie. It feels like a moment. I'd like both of you to just describe what this moment means. What is this moment, Leela?
It's just a lot of pride to see this representation on the big screen and to see it so successful right now. Proud to be, you know, a black woman, proud to be a black person, proud to be African-American, proud to be African, or just a part of the African diaspora. I feel like there's so much representation of strong and beautiful blackness right now, and the conversations and the dialogue that's happening. It's nothing but positive. And the fact that so many kids are able to see this as well.
Hannah, what about you?
For me, it's a chance to appreciate what the real Africa has to offer, and that the greatness and power isn't all made up. Ancient kingdoms, you know, in real life fought off greater powers. As we said, the Byzantines and Romans, more recently white colonial Europeans. The women warriors were real, but also real is the current technological boom in Africa. Lagos, Nairobi, even Accra, even Addis, these are pulsing now with innovation and technology and ideas. And my hope is that it will help people go learn more about Africa. But also, I mean, can I say this? Will the continent benefit from this blockbuster and all this money? You know,
Wakanda theme park.
It's a country that doesn't take foreign aid. There's got to be something there, right?
See? Black Panther roller coaster. We will be on that. But no, I mean, other than that, maybe a film school, maybe film scholarships for students in East Africa. A girl can be hopeful.
Yeah.
Well, to quote the last line of the movie, who are you? They are Hana Baba and Leela Day. They host the podcast, The Soup. Thank you both very much for your thoughts.
Thanks, Marco.
Thank you. Wakanda forever.
So there's the Hollywood depiction of Africa. It's evolving. And then there's the African depiction of Africa. And on that, there's some sad news to report. One of the continent's most acclaimed filmmakers died this weekend, Idrissa Ouedraogo from Burkina Faso. His films often focused on the life in quiet villages, stories that often reveal deep tension in those small towns. Take one of his early films called Yaba. In the film, everyone in this village thinks that a woman there is a witch, except for a young boy who loves her and calls her Yaba, which means grandmother. Lamine Konkobo saw the movie as a kid in Burkina Faso. He's now with the BBC's French for Africa service in London.
I saw the film when I was 13 or something like that, back in primary school. Mm. It is about an old woman accused of witchcraft, you know, something that was very, very prominent in traditional African societies. And what Idrissa wanted actually to show, and this is one, you know, running line of his movie making, to shine a light on the African issues, African traditional issues, issue, the societal issues that were there, and force people who are watching to think about what is going on. And I think that what he wanted here to do is to say that there's no such thing as witchcraft. So he uses storytelling to tackle some of the beliefs that don't stand scientific challenges.
So real stories of real people from Burkina Faso, what's been the reaction? What have you heard from Burkina Faso to his death?
Well, I mean, the president himself, the president of Burkina Faso, said that his death was a tremendous loss to the entire, you know, country. And he went on to say that particularly for the movie industry, the small world of the movie industry in Burkina Faso, that was really a huge blow. But of course, you would hear, for example, people who worked alongside him, like the actor Rosmani Ouédraogo. He's one of the famous actors locally there who played in that Yaba film that you were talking about. He really lamented his passing away, saying that a big baobab, and you know what the baobab is. Huge tree, actually, in West Africa, that a baobab of the Burkina Faso cinema has fallen.
You know, it's interesting that Idrissa Ouédraogo should die this particular weekend with so much of Africa and America and the film-going world talking about Black Panther right now. I mean, this is a Hollywood production with some serious connections to Africa. When we talk about African cinema, though, the kind of storytelling Idrissa Ouédraogo is interested in, would you say that Black Panther is a sign of progress?
Definitely, it is not of the kind of storytelling that Idrissa was interested in. Science fiction was not really Idrissa's forte. But of course, you know, Black Panther tackles a different theme, which is of the realm of the imagination. So Black Panther, would he have seen that as an evolution? Definitely.
Lamine, I gather your kids went to see Black Panther this weekend.
They did.
Did it resonate with them? Were there things that they got really excited about seeing in it?
Well, you know, when you are from Africa and you have kids who have been to Africa with you and they have seen, you know, go from London to Africa and you are a kid, you might actually be shocked. So I have taken my kids home a couple of times and they would actually press me. They would say, "Dad, let's go back home." I would say, "He is home." And they would say, "No, home is." And they would give my address there. But now...
Home is London?
Yeah, home is London. Home is London. And there's no point arguing with them. So when they came here this time, they went out to see that movie and it was representing Africa in this spectacular fashion. They were so taken into the thing itself that they started listening to me when I said that Africa can be a little bit different and that by changing the narrative, things can be brightened, that you can be proud of Africa. My daughter actually said that the movie was just fantastic. And, you know, this is something coming from a little girl who is very difficult to impress. Kung Fu Panda, we went there, everybody enjoyed, but she was like, "Man, I wasn't into that film." But she came out of Black Panther and called me straight saying that, "Wow, Daddy, this is just fantastic. You get to bring yourself around here and watch the movie."
Lamine Konkobo with the BBC's French for Africa service. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marco.
Just ahead on the show, who's afraid of big bad old Russia? You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. Turn on the TV these days, and chances are the news will be painting Russia as the villain.
Taking you to Paris now, where the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, is making his remarks during his trip to Europe there. He's going to be addressing Syria's use of chemical weapons and how Russia supports it. Let's listen in.
President Trump took to Twitter today to unleash another wave of criticism on the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election.
A Russian curling medalist, Alexander Krushelnitsky, charged with a doping offense at Pyeongchang.
From meddling in Syria to meddling in U.S. politics to meddling in the medals at the Olympics, Russia is really in the hot seat these days. Journalist and writer Natalia Antonova joins us from New York City. So it's been a bad press week for all things Russian. You're an American now, Natalia, but does it bother you how much of a bad rap Russia is getting in the media?
Well, I mean, I think that on one hand, obviously, we need our villains, particularly when it comes to foreign villains. We just love them, right? On the other hand, I feel like Russia is often very happy to play up the role of villain. I feel that Vladimir Putin actually on some level buys into the Steve Bannon logic of that, you know, being Darth Vader is a powerful thing. So I'm kind of, you know, 50-50 on this situation right now.
What about these 17 indictments, though? I mean, that's serious stuff. I mean, do Russians back home care about this?
Well, Russians know that nobody's getting extradited. That is just a fact. It's not going to happen. So to them, it's just political theater meant to hurt Trump. And of course, because Russians are more cynical about politics in general and the way our political system works in particular, they basically see this as more of like a power play rather than any kind of a legitimate case.
I mean, a lot of what we saw in this indictment is not new, but it's kind of part of the historic record now. And the press kind of follows that in this country. It seems every news story suggests Russians cheat or are hostile or threatening and crafty. I mean, what do you think all this says about the future of the relationship between the U.S. and Russia?
Well, you know, I am of the opinion that pendulums that swing very far one way will eventually swing back. Mm. And obviously, I'm talking long game here. And by the way, I should point out that the Kremlin really isn't good at long game stuff.
There's been kind of a weird narrative through the weekend. When Donald Trump turns his anger over the Parkland shootings into anger over the FBI and the Mueller investigation, how do you think Russians react to that? I mean, what have you seen? Because I can't imagine how they'd react if Vladimir Putin did the same thing to his investigative bodies.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I feel like it really shows the level of it basically shows us that, you know, Donald Trump is not a statesman. Shocker, right? To alienate, you know, your own guys like that is, you know, not something that can be done. Of course, Putin does it too. I mean, we have to understand that Putin also has like his folksy style and he regularly berates, you know, say his governors. He's much more careful, of course, about publicly berating people who, you know, like work in the security services for a very clear reason. I mean, he was in the KGB himself. Those are the people he respects and understands, and he relies on them for protection and everything else. So I do think that Donald Trump, on the one hand, just seems very foolish here to anyone, to Russians or to us. But at the same time, also, I feel like there is that, you know, because if it's not your president, right, you can sort of have fun with it and see it as an entertaining kind of popcorn-y spectacle. And I feel like to a lot of Russian people right now, it's like, oh, you know, this guy, at least he tells it like it is. He's the only guy in D.C. who just, you know, can't keep his mouth shut for whatever reason, or whether it's pathological or something. And yeah, that's just how he's going to be. So to them, it's more of like, you know, eat the popcorn and watch the crazy, you know, happen in real time, basically.
Journalist and writer Natalia Antonova in New York. Thank you.
Thank you.
Russia's latest controversy, Alexander Krushelnitsky, a Russian Olympic curler, may have to give his bronze medal back because he failed a drug test. This might not seem that surprising given Russia's history, but I mean doping in curling? Who knew that was even a thing? Slava Malamud is a writer based in the U.S. who covers Russian sports. What was your initial thought, Slava, when you heard about this latest doping scandal in curling?
Well, I wasn't really surprised because I don't think anything really changed in Russia with regards to the state-run doping program that has existed there since the early 80s at least. And I don't think any sanctions that IOC wanted to impose changed the mindset in the country. I think the only change that occurred is that, well, let's try to maybe hide it a little bit better. Now, I'm not saying this is 100% true at this point, that Krushelnitsky is guilty, but if that's where the signs are pointing, I don't see how anybody can be surprised.
So the way that curling works, for those of you that have not been watching, is that you slide this heavy stone across the ice and you clear its path with a broom so it can slide more accurately to a target. Slava, it's basically shuffleboard on ice. How could doping even help with that?
Well, yeah, I mean, curling is probably better known to most people, especially in Canada, Northern United States, as a recreational activity. But at this level, it's an Olympic sport, and these athletes are not your regular, you know, weekend bowlers with beer guts. Every inch counts, your heartbeat counts. I don't think that the rep that curling gets as being kind of a semi-recreational leisure activity really matters here.
Well, obviously, I need a reappraisal of curling myself. Russian athletes have already taken a big hit, though. The entire nation was barred from taking part in the Olympics under its flag. What greater impact will this news have on Russian sports beyond what's already happened to the country?
Well, right now, all of Russian media and all of Russian officials, the story they're trying to push is that this is sabotage and this is just somebody trying to discredit Russia once again. And the disagreement right now is whether it was a jealous competitor who did it or whether it's the jealous evil West. And I think the jealous evil West has a healthy lead right now. So until the government in Russia changes, which it's not going to change on a whim or anytime soon, nothing is going to change. In Russia, sports is a part of foreign policy. It's part of the way Russia wants to present itself. And winning gold medals is a big, huge part of the government's approach to running the country.
So is being a Russian sports writer these days, does it become a political beat as opposed to a sports beat?
Sports is always political in Russia. A sports beat is always a political beat. It's just a choice you have to make whether you're going to maintain your own opinion or you're going to parrot the party line. And unfortunately, 90% of my colleagues have made a choice to parrot the party line. Yeah. And that's one way to stay gainfully employed, and it's one way to avoid major headaches. But sport never stopped being political in Russia. It has been since the times of the Soviet Union, and it still is now.
Everybody wants to win. I think we can call that a universal truth almost. What do you wish Americans could understand about Russian athletes and what drives their desire to win?
There is a lot of hurt right now among Russian athletes. I'm not sure how many of them have taken the substances willingly and knowingly, and how many of them were simply following the directions of the coaches and doctors without really asking what's in this stuff, simply because that's not the thing you do in Russia. But as athletes, it's hard to differentiate between Americans and Russians. They all do the same thing basically on a daily routine basis, and they're all trying to achieve the same goals. It's just, you know, they're Russian people, and they're with all the foibles and all the issues that are involved with being a Russian.
Slava Malamud is a sports writer and a politics writer because, as he says, sports is politics. Thanks very much for being with us, Slava.
Thank you very much.
I'm Marco Werman. We still don't know what caused U.S. personnel in Cuba to get sick back in 2016, but those so-called sonic attacks certainly led to some strange symptoms.
We found that it was really a concussion without concussion. It just so much appeared like persistent concussion symptoms without that normal history of a head impact.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Massachusetts has close to 200 massage businesses that appear to offer legitimate services, but in fact they are an illegal front for the commercial sex industry. This also implies, in many cases, human trafficking. This is what my colleagues here at WGBH News discovered. Philip Martin is a senior investigative reporter. Jennifer McKim is with the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. And together they produced a five-part series about the illicit massage industry, a local problem with sordid international connections. So Jennifer, typically, if there is a typical, who are the women who end up in these massage parlors?
So we found that there are something like 23 to 25,000 women across the U.S. who are working in these illicit massage businesses. Most of them are coming from Asian countries, China, Thailand, South Korea. Many of them have overstayed visas when they arrived here and then sort of being fed across the U.S. When they come to places like Massachusetts, they are often put on buses, arrive in parlors where they don't even know where they are. They often sleep there until they're shipped off somewhere else.
Philip, what kind of stories have you heard from them? I mean, are they lured into a kind of proposition where life will be better for them in the States and then it all goes completely wrong once they get here?
That's pretty much the story, but it's also varied. We've spoke to a researcher who basically found that some of these women, once they're in this life, that many stay because, as some say, this is all they know. Many are also trying to leave this life. You have a very extraordinary case out of Minneapolis that was tried last year in which Thai women who were working in massage parlors, illicit massage parlors, they owed a debt, and that debt was being traded like trading cards amongst human traffickers. So they, in this case, had absolutely no choice in terms of what they were doing. We spoke to one woman also who, like a lot of women in illicit massage, are basically coming out of Flushing, Queens, once arriving from China. And she answered an ad in a Chinese-speaking newspaper, and she ended up in a massage parlor in Baltimore and others all over the East Coast, basically being prostituted. Here's her story.
At the time, I thought it was just massages and didn't think more about anything. And the boss basically told me I needed to give my passport to them so I will not run away with their money. So the boss put me in a car and then drove me to somewhere. And I had no idea where I was going. And after I got there, they forced me to do sex work.
Jennifer, are these women considered sex slaves? Are they being held against their will? And are they forced to perform sexual acts for clients well beyond massage?
Some people call them that. Some people say it's a lot more complicated. Most of them are not being held enslaved in the traditional way you would think, with shackles down in the basement. Most of them are there. They could walk out. But as I said, a lot of them don't even know where they are. They are told by their traffickers, by the people, that if they go out, that they are doing something illegal, that they will be deported, that they're scared, and they owe a lot of money. Some of them are threatened by people that if they do go to police, then that they will end up having their families hurt back in their home countries. So there's a lot of complicated reasons why these women stay. And one of them is actually just poverty and not really having any other choices.
We often hear the egregious examples of, you know, a dozen women found in a shipping container, but I suspect that most of them are brought here in much more banal ways.
Yeah, I talked to one woman who thought she was getting a job as a restaurant. When she was picked up in JFK, she was brought into a house where she was raped and traumatized. So a lot of them do come for different reasons, and then they owe these huge debts. As Philip said, one of these cases in Minnesota where one of the women who actually bought the debt of 15 women and basically owned them until they paid off the debts, which are often $30,000, $40,000, $50,000.
What kind of life do these women have, like outside of this massage parlor that they work in? What are their living arrangements?
You find the only time they went out was to take out the trash. They were living on cots. Some were living on massage parlor tables, the same tables where these sex acts were taking place. So they live in horrendous conditions. Now, much of this is believed to be under the control of criminal enterprises, organized crime. While there are 200 illicit massage parlors, almost 200, I should say, in Massachusetts, you have, by one estimate, the Polaris Project, which came out with a new study, 9,000 across the country. So you have quite a few women who are basically being indentured.
What legal recourse do these women have?
It's very difficult. When law enforcement finds them, generally they're afraid to talk. There has been, over years, efforts to close down places and arrest the women as prostitutes. And now there's more of this effort, understanding that they are being trafficked, and to go after both the buyers as well as the operators. But they often don't cooperate because they are afraid. They're afraid of the police. They're afraid to talk. There's been several major cases here in Massachusetts where the AG's office has come in and closed down places, and the women flee, and they're hard to find.
So let's talk about the clients for a moment, the Johns. You found also, after speaking with many of them, that they had already had histories of sex tourism in other countries. So it sounds like these Johns are in a world that they're already accustomed to.
You have various types of Johns, some who make no apologies about what they're doing. And one man we spoke with traveled the world and basically indulged himself overseas.
There's parts of the world where this isn't a big deal. China, or if you're in South America, this isn't a big deal. I remember, you know, traveling to foreign cities and being in very dangerous parts of the city, you know, looking for this type of activity.
It was only when he would return to Massachusetts, to Boston, and within his own neighborhood that he was more wary. After a while, of course, he found this entire thing to be problematic, and that was because of a single factor. He was caught, not by the police, but by his wife.
Jennifer, tell me about these so-called John's boards, basically customer review websites, and in this case, male customers reviewing masseuses, prostitutes, right?
Yes. This was how I sort of got involved in this story, was somebody showed me this online review board called Rub Maps, which is a roadmap for all these places around the country. There's over 7,000 of them on this website. And basically, sex buyers are saying in explicit terms what type of services they got, how much they paid for it, types of reviews that you see online for restaurants,
right,
in terms of, is it clean or is it not? How do you get there? How do you not?
Incredible.
And then really talking about women as if they were objects.
And is it making it easier for police to target the workers and the jobs.
It's very interesting because, yes, for one way, it's making it easier for buyers to find these places, to know when they go in that they can get these services, because they'll also say, warning, this place isn't erotic. So it's helping the buyers, but it's also helping the anti-sex trafficking law enforcement around the country. They're using them to go after these places.
But at the same time, you find many of these people who run these places, these criminals, they're becoming more sophisticated. And they're using loopholes wherever they can to open these places. Rather than calling something massage, you call it body works.
So what was the hardest part about covering the subject?
I think the biggest challenge was talking to the women. These women are very afraid and ashamed and hard to talk to.
I got to ask you as well, Philip, how much has the crackdown on immigration generally under Trump added another layer of worry for women who have been trafficked from overseas?
Tremendous impact. When you have a situation where anyone who's undocumented, who's overstayed their visa, is targeted, regardless of who they may be, you find yourself with a major problem. Now, traditionally, what we've found in this country over the last decade is the issuing of something called U visas and another visa called T visas. T visas are for trafficking victims. U visas are for those who have been affected by crime. And so these women would qualify quite often for these visas. But in speaking with advocates and speaking with immigration attorneys, we found that many of these women, as they're waiting for their T visa to come through, which were issued without any problem under the Obama administration and the Bush administration, now what they're finding is while some of them are waiting for their T visas, that many of these women have been picked up by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and have been detained, even as they have been also been victimized in these illicit massage parlors. And so as someone pointed out, many of these women are being doubly criminalized.
Jennifer McKim with the New England Center for Investigative Reporting and Philip Martin, my colleague here at WGBH, senior investigative reporter. Thank you both very much for telling us about this.
Thank you, Marco.
Thank you for having us.
It was one of the more bizarre stories we've seen out of Cuba. In late 2016, American staff with the newly reopened U.S. Embassy in Havana started hearing noises like this. The sounds seemed targeted directly at these Americans' houses or hotel rooms, and if people heard that noise right after, they'd start feeling sick.
Word tonight that some American diplomats serving in Cuba are said to not only have suffered mild traumatic brain injuries, but also some with permanent hearing loss, loss of balance, severe headaches, and cognitive disruption.
Lots of speculation followed about what this was. Some said it was some kind of sonic attack. Others called it mass hysteria. The State Department itself still doesn't seem to have any answers, but this mystery does have a medical aspect to it that doctors are getting a little closer to solving. The World's Carolyn Beeler reports.
Last spring, when word started spreading about the headaches and hearing loss and dizziness, around 80 Americans in Cuba were worried enough to get checked out by a doctor. More than 20 were diagnosed with mild traumatic brain injury by last summer. State Department officials said trauma from a, quote, non-natural source caused it, but they didn't know much else. So they contacted brain trauma expert Dr. Douglas Smith.
Well, actually, it was an email, and I was worried it was a hoax, you know, but it looked legitimate enough, so I did call them back.
When he did, the State Department asked Smith to assemble a team of specialists at the University of Pennsylvania to examine the patients. It was August, months after most of them had heard the mysterious noises.
They weren't getting better. They weren't going back to work. They were still having a lot of symptoms. And nobody had been able to figure out what was going on.
This is Dr. Sean Grady, who helped test 21 Americans in Philadelphia.
There were several cases that were really physically disabling. They had difficulty getting their eyes to focus, trouble with concentration and memory, and headaches when they engaged in tasks, and balance difficulties. And these are all younger individuals.
Three of the patients had so much hearing damage, they needed hearing aids. 15 had to take drugs to help them sleep. Smith says the symptoms were hallmarks of concussion.
We found that it was really a concussion without concussion. It just so much appeared like persistent concussion symptoms without that normal history of a head impact.
But those are just symptoms. The cause was still a mystery when the team finished their examinations in September. By then, the stranger-than-fiction scenario had already taken its toll on U.S.-Cuba diplomatic relations.
The Trump administration announced Friday that it is pulling more than half of its staff out of the American embassy in Havana.
Doctors don't think the sound that the Americans heard caused their injuries. Audible sound isn't known to be able to hurt your brain. So other theories have emerged. One is that some type of sonic weapon using sound outside the audible range was targeted at the Americans, and the noise they heard was just a byproduct. But so far, the FBI has found no evidence that happened. Here's another theory. The symptoms stem from a kind of collective stress response. A few Americans heard an unfamiliar noise, maybe just cicadas, and thought it was making them sick. Through the power of suggestion, dozens of others started feeling symptoms too. That's the conclusion of a panel of Cuban scientists, but after his evaluation, Smith doesn't buy it.
There'd have to be almost like a grand conspiracy to go and research what concussion symptoms look like, come before a group of experts and convince each one that they had an issue. And that's including going through some tests you can't fake.
A third theory is that a virus or bacteria or poison is to blame. Smith doesn't think that's it either. His team published a case study in the Journal of the American Medical Association last week detailing what they argue is a brand new syndrome. But key patient details that would normally be included were withheld for privacy and security reasons.
I think the lack of some of the demographic data just makes it more difficult to interpret the findings of the study.
This is Stephen Lewis, a neurologist who published an editorial alongside the study.
So, for example, if the patients were 38 and had hearing loss, that would be potentially more significant than if the patients were 58 and had hearing loss.
Lewis argues it's just too soon to rule out any potential causes of the brain injuries.
It is a mystery, and we need more information. And unfortunately, the findings from this study provide data, but really no answers yet.
Doctors at the University of Pennsylvania hope they'll have more information soon. Right now, Sean Grady says they're analyzing the results of a special type of brain scan that typically reveals damage to the wiring of the brain in concussion patients.
If we're going to find imaging evidence of problems, that's where we'll find it.
And if they do,
now we've got something that we can go back into a laboratory environment and try and replicate.
In a mystery where every possible explanation seems unlikely, a little hard science might be the only hope of cracking the case. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Perseverance in the face of tragedy. We saw a lot of that over the weekend among the survivors of last week's school shooting in Florida. Like that young woman, Emma Gonzalez, who spoke at a rally in Fort Lauderdale, saying, "Enough is enough. This is the last school shooting." If it seems like it's hard to solve this deeply entrenched problem, well, that's perhaps what a group of women thought 50 years ago in Britain about the very dangerous but very profitable fishing industry. But these women, the headscarf revolutionaries, as they were known, did manage to change the laws around commercial fishing in the UK. For the BBC Witness program, my colleague Simon Watts has this look back at their story.
59 men dead, 3 trawlers lost, and 3 more stranded in the unbearably cold waters off Iceland.
In the winter of 1968, trawlermen from Hull paid a deadly price for bringing Britain its fish.
They continued to go where the fish were, even though they knew it was dangerous. Being a trawlerman is always dangerous.
But this time, their wives said enough was enough.
You wanted to help. You wasn't quite sure what you could do, but you knew that you could do something.
Some of them came to London. Something they demanded had to be done before more men died.
In the 1960s, the British deep water fishing industry was the biggest in the world. It was based in the northeastern port of Hull, and particularly the working class district around Hessel Road. Yvonne Blenkinsop grew up there and spoke to the BBC in the 1990s.
My father went to sea, and when my brothers was old enough, they went to sea. My mother's only brother, he went to sea. We were a family of fishermen.
Although the fishing industry was lucrative, it was also one of the most dangerous in Britain. The laws governing fishing in Britain had not changed since the early 19th century. That meant corners were cut with safety as trawlers ventured out without enough crew, radios or medical equipment. Many fishermen were losing their lives.
If any of them spoke up, they knew that they'd be in for it, because speaking up could mean losing their job.
In early 1968, 3 Hull trawlers went down in fierce storms. The St. Romanus was the first to sink, with 20 lives lost.
When I heard of the first trawler was missing, no one knew where it was. I could not sleep. My two young brothers at sea, 17 and 22. I was worried sick out my mind for them. But we didn't know where the ship was. They'd hardly have daylight out there. And then we found out there was no radio operator on board. Well, it was just unbelievable. In 1968, not to have a radio operator on board.
Then a second trawler, the Kingston Peridot, went missing with another 20 men on board. On Hull's Hessel Road, the fishermen's wives were distraught.
People was huddled in little groups on Hessel Road, mothers, daughters, with the children. Everyone spoke in hushed tones, as if he was literally at a funeral. We was all waiting for a miracle, but it didn't happen that way. I was losing my friends right, left and centre. I just wanted to help. Someone had to.
The women began to protest, led by local Lillian Biloca, better known as Big Lil. Big Lil organised a petition to the trawler owners for proper safety measures, and Lil stationed herself at the dock to personally check all the ships.
It's all full crew, lads. Radio operator. All the best flowers.
Do you think you're doing any good with this vigil?
Well, we stopped a ship from going without a radio operator, haven't we? That's a start. It's not the finish, it's the start.
How much more of this do you intend to do?
The rest of my life.
How do you regard yourself, Mrs. Willock, as a sort of suffragette?
That'd be daft.
The press loved Big Lil's larger-than-life character, and the BBC was on hand when the fishermen's wives organised a public meeting.
Everybody in Hull, all the women, seem to be more angry than grieved. Why do you think this is?
It could have been more angry.
The conditions that have been different. There have been more lives saved at sea within these last few years.
It's so much of it going on now.
A lot of these women felt so helpless. They needed to do something. They wanted to do something. And getting to the meeting, signing a petition, was their way of saying, please, please, look, help us. There was a lot of emotion there. There was anger that no one was answering us when we was asking for help. But basically, we was just crying inside. We was desperate.
Yvonne Blenkinsop was chosen to form what became known as the Hessel Road Committee, along with Big Lil Biloca, Mary Dinesh and Christine Jensen. The committee held an unprecedented meeting with the powerful trawler owners. Then a third ship, the Ross Cleveland, went down with the loss of another 18 lives. The women in their fishwives' headscarves became front-page news.
A deputation of fishermen's wives from Hull is leaving for London this morning to talk to ministers about safety at sea.
The committee headed for the capital to try to force the government to take action. Big Lil would not be taking no for an answer.
What do you do after you've interviewed the minister?
If I can get satisfaction, I'm prepared to come home. But if I don't get satisfaction, I'll be at that Wilson's house, private house, till I do get satisfaction in some shape or form.
Recollections, after all these years, are very blurred, but I do have a couple. We was taken to meet the ministers, and I said, I'm going to say all of my list. I'm not going to stop until I've given you the whole lot. So he laughed at me. No one was going to put me off. I was going to get every one of the points that I wanted to put down for safety for our fishermen. And they said they was going to look into it, and they felt sure that they was definitely going to do something.
It took nearly 4 hours at the Board of Trade today to reach agreement between the government, the trawler owners and the unions.
Under pressure from the women, the industry agreed that radio equipment would be compulsory, ships would be fully crewed, and that a mothership with medical equipment would always accompany the fleet and supervise its operations.
It seems a fairly complete victory for the fishermen's wives of Hull.
In fact, the women had achieved more than men had managed in the previous century. In Hull, it was time for a party.
There was jubilant, there was clapping and... You didn't forget the tragedy. Bye, no, I don't mean that at all. What I do mean is, it was the first good thing in these weeks of this grief and this anger and frustration.
The new regulations led to a massive improvement in safety, but there was a backlash from many of the men in the fishing industry. They felt that the women had interfered in their world and that if trawlers were kept in port, there'd be less fishing. Big Lil received death threats. Yvonne was hit in the face by a man in a restaurant. But the four women who led the campaign stuck to their guns. And looking back in the 1990s, Yvonne's friend and fellow campaigner, Mary Dennis, said it transformed their lives.
I was never quite the same again. We were not a women's movement. We were purely campaigning in support of our menfolk away at sea. But in doing so, it did help a lot of us find our own identity. And then you can never quite go back and be the same as you were before.
Mary Dennis there, one of the headscarf revolutionaries, ending that report from the BBC's Simon Watts. And that'll do it for us today. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.